Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Songs of Our Lives. I'm Brad Rose. I'm an artist, a composer, a writer, the founder of Foxy Digitalis, and somebody who thinks about music and sound far more than is healthy. Each week, I invite on a guest to talk about these songs, the music that has meant a lot to them and left its mark. Previous guests include Helado Negro, Jeff Tobias, Ava Mendoza, David Grubbs, Anna Butters, and so many more. This week, I am so excited to have the one, the only, Sam Sadomski, a.k.a. The Bird Calls. Sam is somebody who, we go way back, and we talk about that, so I'm not going to get too much into that, but Sam used to write for Foxy Digitalis 100 years ago in its sort of previous incarnation before it came back in 2021. And, Sam was like one of the, so I'm a huge Bruce Springsteen fan. Everybody knows Sam's a huge Bruce Springsteen fan. That was kind of one of the ways that we really first bonded, because in a world where covering experimental like music in the margins, stuff that's way out there, I didn't know a lot of people who were obsessed with Bruce Springsteen. So Sam was, I was, it was great. Anyway, his project, The Bird Calls, has been a personal favorite for many, many years. He was self-releasing so many just awesome, you know, they were pretty, there was just like guitar and vocal albums on his Bandcamp for years, like especially, you know, when he was neck deep writing for and as an editor at Pitchfork, he was just cranking out these albums where the songwriting, the lyricism, it was so, I just found it so like captivating, and it really just captured these like very specific moments and feelings. And just a really, I don't know, it's like this really sort of like subdued and beautiful way. But he has a new album out called Melody Trail. It's on Ruination, and it's kind of like a full band record. It's awesome. It just kind of takes everything I love about the Birdhouse is my backyard gallery. Jesus Christ, Brad, takes everything about the Bird Calls and just kind of amps it all up to 11, you know. Can't recommend it enough. It's out now, and anytime you see something written by Sam, you should read it, because he's a fabulous writer and just a wonderful human being. So we had so much fun doing this. It was sort of stroll down memory lane. I mean, that's kind of what the show is in some ways, but this was more so than others. And hope you all enjoy it. My guest today is a musician, a songwriter, an editor, a writer, a Bruce Springsteen fan.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to say a Foxy Digitalis alum. It's Sam Sadomski.
Hi, Brad. Thank you for having me on.
So, how's it going?
Oh, it's pretty good. Yeah, I'm feeling good. TGIF vibe.
Yeah. So, Bird Calls, your solo project, has a new album out called Melody Trail on February 7th on Ruination Record Company. And this album, man, first of all, I'm just going to say this album rules. And I've been a big fan of the Bird Call stuff for a long, long time. But this one, God, like all the different stuff you guys are playing on it, or you and I guess other people. It's like a full band record.
Yeah, thank you. It definitely feels that way. But it's really just me and this one guy. His name's Ryan Weiner, and he produced it and mixed it and mastered it. And it's just the two of us. We basically just hung out in the studio he built in his basement and just passed around instruments and listened to the demos and created like one, like each session we basically brought a song in and just like dreamed up what we could do with it, and it was truly so much fun and so inspiring. And yeah, I've really never made a record like that before that has so many different elements to it. And yeah, I'm still like still feeling really joyous from that whole experience.
That's awesome. How have you started playing these songs live? Like, how are you translating it into like a live setting, or have you even?
Yeah, I've played a few of them. I like during shows where it's just me and a guitar, but I just had my first rehearsal with a full band, and it is so fun. Like, I've played guitar in bands, but I've never led a band in my life. Uh-huh. And oh my God, I'm so happy to be doing it. It's so fun. It's like the most fun you can have. It's also just been really gratifying, because I'm playing with like some of the most talented musicians I know, and that's so cool. Yeah, it's been really rewarding.
That's awesome. Yeah, every day I think like, man, I need to start a band. I've been like in a band for so long. Everybody should start a band. Damn it, 2025. Yeah. Let's all start a band. One of the things I always have been a fan of your lyrics. One of the lyrics in this album is, "It hits so close to home." Do what you love for a living and you'll never love a day in your life.
Oh, yeah.
Such a good, brutal line. So I just wanted to mention that. I don't know what that, I have no question.
Yeah, it kind of speaks for itself, I guess.
Yeah, I just love it. Yeah. But speaking of the lyrics, one of the things that was kind of in the album, like the one sheet or whatever, you talked about getting more than you asked for, which I thought was a really interesting, like, kind of way of phrasing it. And I'm curious kind of what you meant by that, and how, like, doing this record, if it's sort of taught you anything about managing expectations and stuff like that with your art, and embracing like unpredictability and stuff like that.
Oh yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, definitely. I think, I don't know, especially with like making music, I try not to have too many extant expectations to it. Like, I try to keep it within my control, what I want out of it, which is usually just like making more records and writing more songs. Like, I mean, I was just saying to someone, like, they were like talking about writing a song they hate, and I'm like, I write stupid songs all the time because I'm really into finishing songs, and like I always think like the best thing is like right after it. You know, you never know. Like, but in terms of that line, I got more than I asked for. That's like specifically coming after like the Morrissey quote I do, where it's like, I was looking for a job and then I found a job, and it's like, I got more than I asked for it. So there's like multiple meanings there. Yeah. But yeah, that song, it's from the title track, the song called Melody Trail. That's like, I guess, pretty autobiographical about different things I was going through and like kind of starting like living with more intention or something. Yeah.
What, I'm curious at how you're, so obviously, I mean, a lot of people are going to like know you as a music writer, or as a writer. Music writer feels way too pigeonholed. And obviously that's how we first met, 'cause you wrote for Foxy. Like, it must have been like the death throes of Foxy, because I don't know, like, it was,
I ended it.
Yeah, well, that's
I mean, you were the first person to like give me a writing gig on the internet that wasn't my own blog. I remember it was in like early 2011.
Okay.
And you sent me, I was in college, and you sent me like a box of CDs and records, and one of them was an advanced copy of Wit's End by Cass McCombs. And I think that was like the first thing I wrote for the internet.
Man,
I was so excited. I still love that record. Cause
it's a great record.
Like, when I was a kid, all I wanted was to hear albums before everyone else. Like, yeah. That was like the dream. And like, then it finally happened and I was so psyched. But yeah, I loved Foxy Digitalis. I was trying to think of how I found out about it. I think it was probably cause when I was in high school, I like got a subscription to The Wire mm-hmm. magazine. I got really into One of Tricks Point Never, and he wrote for Foxy Digitalis, I think.
He did, yeah, like for a brief period. Very little known fact, but yeah. Our most famous alumni.
I just, I probably found it through following him, and I was turned on to so much music and music that I didn't know like, not only was I not familiar with the artist, but I wasn't familiar with like the genre that they were working in. I mean, it really like opened my mind. And yeah, it also, I feel like I kind of learned how to write for like an actual, like having an editor and like an audience reading it. Like that was kind of my first experience with that.
Man, well, that's awesome. Well, hey, went on to lots of other things. That's cool. Yeah, I mean, I was saying this before we were off air. Oh, and by the way, like the hearing things before they come out, like I still get a thrill out of that. Like I've been doing this for 30 freaking years, and it's still like when something shows up in my inbox, I'm like, ooh, like. Really? But then I hate when I can't tell anybody about it because it's like, oh, embargoed until this. It's like, fuck, I can't say anything. But it's so. And then I totally lost what I was going to say there. So never mind. That was great. Jesus Christ. Wow. It's been a long week. So yeah. Well, I think that's, oh, I know what I was going to say. Yeah. The thing I was telling you this before, the thing that I so remember is like you and I would have, I think we would like exchange emails about Bruce Springsteen.
Yes.
Because nobody else, like that was, I don't know. I feel like that was at a time where like, cause like a lot of like the scenes that I was part of and stuff, like, I don't know, talking about mainstream stuff, just not cool or not whatever. Maybe it still isn't. I don't know. But like, it feels like whatever now. I mean, I'm 45 years old. I don't care. But I still remember that because I mean, I've loved Bruce Springsteen as long as I can remember. And people would just be like looking at me like I was an alien or something. And I will never forget then the, like, I mean, it's the photo everyone's seen of you like on stage hugging.
Yeah.
Like, and I just, holy shit, that was, yeah. So.
Which was like right around the time that I was like writing for you and like meeting all the people and like that crew. And it was funny to have that be like, it was like my profile picture on everything as it should have been. But yeah. No, I remember that. I remember talking to you about Bruce Springsteen and also Destroyer.
Yeah.
A lot back then. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Still. Yeah. God. Love Dan Behar. Who has a new album coming out, but that has nothing to do with anything. Speaking of hearing things before they come out. Yeah. Okay. Well, I could go on and on about this, but it's, you know, Friday afternoon. Everybody's got probably other things they want to do. So I don't know. Nobody else is listening to this on Friday afternoon. So if it gets weird, that's why. Like my brain is checked out. All right, let's get into the meat of this. And as ever, we're going to start.
Cool. Yeah.
What is the first song that you remember?
Before, I just want to preface all of my picks by saying I felt like the only way I could tackle this and not like overthink it into oblivion was just to try to be as like honest as possible, even like at the detriment of like the portrait it paints of me as a music listener. Like, so I'm like going for accuracy, not necessarily like to showcase my depth or anything.
I was saying, like, this playlist rules. I made a play. I've been listening to it in the car the last few days, and it's made me very happy because you picked a lot of music that, whatever, if cool or not, like, I mean, a lot of stuff that I really love and stuff that I haven't thought about for a while, and so I'm really curious to hear too, like, where it fits in and all that. So what's the first thing you remember?
The first thing I remember is the song from Greece, These Magic Changes, Those Magic Changes, it's one or the other, which shows you how little impact that song has. But I was like, it's either that or like the Hanukkah prayer, which I always liked as a kid, like the blessing you say around the menorah, which I still think is really pretty. But this song, it was like, I picked it because it was the first song I remember like triggering something in me. Like my parents showed me and my sister Grease when we were really little. It's like one of my formative memories is watching that movie. And for some reason, that song just like lit up something in my brain, and I like wanted to rewind the scene. And I think like the character who sang it was named Duty, which I also like. So there's like a joke in my family about like the Duty song, which is what I called it. But yeah, it's funny. I listen to it now to like fact check that memory, and I was like, a few things stood out to me. I'm curious what you thought if you listened to it, but I was like, one, it really like primed me to be a huge Springsteen fan. Like it has that old like rock, like pre rock and roll thing going for it. Mm-hmm. And that was also like, it's interesting. It's a song about music, like about the power of music, which I think also is interesting. Three, I'm like, it's such a sentimental song for like a young boy to like relate to versus like Grease Lightning or something. Yeah, that song was like my first musical love. I really dug it.
Yeah, I don't like, I've seen Grease maybe twice. I was thinking about this, how, because I have friends, I think even Eden, like my wife, I think she was obsessed with Grease growing up, but for some reason nobody in my family seemed to care about Grease. Mm-hmm. But when I was listening to it, it did I'm kind of a sucker for, like, I don't know, I love songs that are about like the magic of music or like about music. That always kind of does the thing for me. But the thing you mentioned about how it like primed you for being a Bruce Springsteen fan, I hadn't thought about that, but that makes a lot of sense. Like, I think that's spot on.
Yeah, I mean, it really feels like the Born to Run era, you know, because like, yeah, by that record, he's like invoking Roy Orbison and like wearing the like leather jacket and stuff. Mm-hmm. I think like, I remember like so little about Grease. I haven't probably watched it since I was a little kid, but I just like remember that imagery. And yeah, it was like a nice runway into the thing that ended up ruling my life shortly after.
Yeah. Well, what is a song? Well, first of all, are you a big crier? Do you think of yourself as a big crier?
No, not at all. Although this year, a few things have already made me cry. So maybe I'm changing, but no, historically, not really. Yeah.
What is the song that either it makes you cry or it makes you kind of like feel that kind of way, if it, you know, doesn't actually make you cry?
Well, for this one, I went with a song that was written by a friend of mine. The song Was I Cruel by Office Culture, which is the band that's led by Winston Cook Wilson. Yeah. Are you familiar?
Yes. I'm trying to remember if I interviewed, I don't know. I've written about him. I wrote about this record too, I think, last year.
Yeah.
And did I interview I can't remember. That's bad. I've interviewed too many people. But yeah, you know, and the funny thing is when I was thinking about this, when I first ever heard Office Culture, and like you and I hadn't been in touch in a long time at that point, but I had read your writing and knew like the Bird Call stuff. Maybe we'd kind of been, anyway, the two people I didn't realize at that point, I knew you guys were friends, but like the two people I thought of I was like, my friend Andrew and Sam would totally love this. So I feel very vindicated.
Yeah. I love Winston's music so much. And like, it really, I mean, beyond the fact of us being friends and stuff, it really influenced the music I make and the way I approach my like songwriting as a creative practice and stuff. But to me, this song is really next level and really emotionally profound and complex. I was thinking about how like for a lot of people, when you start writing songs, it's like, there's this perspective you give of yourself in the writing that's like this almost tragic hero. Like, mm-hmm. it grants you a lot of like creative freedom when your songwriting is a place where like you as a narrator or someone that like terrible things happen to, and you write the song as a means of like resilience or like, And then maybe when you progress or evolve as a songwriter, like, you get really fascinated writing songs that are like the opposite, where you're like kind of villainous and your songs are like embracing like your position as like someone who's like, I don't know, untrustworthy or like inflicting hurt or something like that. But Winston really refuses to put his songs in boxes like that. Like, all of his songs are so complex. And so, which I think is a lot realer, like it speaks to real emotional truths. And the first time I heard Was I Cruel, I was so moved by it. The lyrics to me, they present this very visceral thought spiral kind of, and then he's also just such a talented musician that the song itself kind of tells a story the way it builds, mm-hmm. the layers of harmonies singing along with it, even though Like, it remains in the first person all the way through. It feels very communal. I can't say I've ever really heard a song that's about this particular subject matter of, like, the song kind of all takes place in this, like, microsecond of an argument between two people, but he just is able to magnify that moment so well and with such, like, intense focus. It's like a very cerebral way of saying that, like, every time I hear the song, I'm just so moved. That song continues to move me.
Yeah, I mean, this song and a lot of his stuff, it's the thing. I've heard it a lot of, so many times. I probably haven't heard it as many times as you have, but, like, I keep finding things in it. And I always think of a lot of his songs, like, his approach to songwriting is just so, he has that thing where, like you said, it's, like, so complex, but there's this, like, air of effortlessness to it that is not at all, like, it's, and balancing those two things, I think, A, it makes it kind of easier to, like, get into it, and then, like, once you're inside of the song, you can't stop, like, thinking about it, or, you know, you, like, there's just so many places to go.
Yeah, I think it's maybe because he's incredibly conversational as a writer. Mm. Like, you almost don't realize the level of insight that it's almost like a stand-up comedian, the way, like, it developed, which we talk about a lot, because, like, with Winston's songs, like, a lot of people tend to characterize them as, like, wry, humorous, like, just, I think, because he plays piano and, like, sings the way he sings. Whereas, like, with my music, a lot of times, even if I'm, like, telling literal jokes, people will talk about it as, like, vulnerable and, like, stark, you know, just because I, like, have, like, a kind of, like, shaky, maybe, like, emo-er delivery. But, like, I do think, like, Winston songwriting can be really, like, devastating, and casually devastating, which makes it more devastating, you know.
Yeah.
But no, it's true. It's, like, an unassuming way of approaching, like, really massive topics.
Yeah, casually devastating. I like that. That's really good. yeah. Okay, well, on the other side of this, what's a song that'll put you in a better mood?
Okay, well, this is the one I picked for Springsteen for, which, okay. Like, this song could have been my answer to any number of these, including the last one, but I went with Darkness on the Edge of Town for this.
Yeah.
Which, frankly, song. That's like, probably my favorite song ever.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah, it's... I've never done, like, I don't know. Incident on 57th Street remains my favorite Springsteen song of all time, but this is right up there.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I mean, I love Incident too. Darkness for me, it's like, I don't know. I think it's maybe the song I've tried to, like, absorb the most into my own writing. It's also one of his songs that I think is the most adaptable. Like, I love the way he plays it solo acoustic. I obviously love the full band version from, like, the Darkness and the River Tours. I love the way he plays it with the band now. I just saw him play it last weekend. Like a Light of Day festival with Joe Grushecki. It always does it for me. And I thought about it, and I think this is probably the answer, like the prompt that it's the most suitable for. Because to me, it's like the ultimate pump up song. And for him, I think it serves a similar purpose. Like, you'll notice he puts it really early in his solo sets when he's doing, like, solo acoustic shows, and in the E Street Band sets, it generally has that sort of triumphant feeling to it, which is interesting because if you look at the lyrics and the way he's adjusted the lyrics over the years, it's like a pretty brutal narrative. Like,
right.
The guy in the song, he's divorced, he's lost his money, he's, like, following a crisis of faith, he, like, doesn't believe in God anymore. He's, like, alone at the top of a hill. Like, it's, like, so dramatic. <Right. laughs> But for some reason, it's like, a song. It's almost too easy to say it's, like, a song about persevering, because I don't think it is. It's, like, a song about, like, acknowledging all these things are true and, like, giving voice to them, which, like, I don't know. I think maybe even as a kid was, like, an element of Bruce's music that really excited me. It was just the sense of, like, I don't know, this adult voice, like, showing you that, like I remember being really moved by the second verse when I was a kid, the one that's like, everybody's got a secret, something they just can't face, you know, until one day you cut it loose or let it drag you down. Like that thing, it's just so wise and leaves so much space for like the listener to let it pump them up however they want to be pumped up. But yeah, so I would say that's a song I listen to, like, I don't know, if I need like a bolt of adrenaline or like, I don't know. This was a hard one to pick something for at first, because anytime I have like people over to my apartment and they're looking through my records for something to listen to, it's like all just like first name, last name of very depressed people. Like, I'm not one for like party music, I guess.
I relate. Yeah, I can clear a room real easy. Just pull anything off my record shelf and it's probably gonna I'm thinking of this now, like, it's like, you know, we're not gonna do the like best hype song question, but it's so true, but it's so weird to think of this as like a pick me up hype song, because yeah, but it is. It totally is. Kind of the genius of it, like
yeah. I mean, even like when he plays it live, and for the last iteration of the word town, how he, you know, it's like ingrained in any Bruce fan's head, like that last like octave jump at the end, it feels like true, like literal uplift.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. So that's my answer. But
Hey, that's.
It's also my favorite song. So it's also kind of my answer for that. But I picked something else for that one. I tried to do like one artist.
I mean, you probably could have done like Bruce for all of them.
I thought about doing that. You know, like, if you don't feel like talking about Bruce, I would feel like the ultimate commentary.
That'd be kind of fun. Okay, well, everybody's favorite question: what is objectively the greatest song of all time?
Yeah, I thought about this one for a while too.
If it's not Darkness in the Edge Town.
Well, my gut response was Born to Run, but I was like, I'd rather pick like a Bruce song I maybe have like a more personal relationship with. Right. Although Born to Run is like objectively the best song of all time. But the other objective best song of all time I picked was A Case of You by Joni Mitchell.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even know. Like, this is what, I'm not even sure what to say about it, because it's a perfect song.
It really is. And I think like I could argue the objectivity of it being the best song ever, and that like it succeeds on every imaginable level, and it has endured like some dreadful covers of it, and it has endured in a way that other songs from the era haven't. From like the first line, "Just Before Our Love Got Lost," like it places you in a moment that pretty much anyone can relate to, and it's a moment like you can kind of only acknowledge in retrospect, which had this like inbuilt nostalgia to the song that, I don't know, I can't think of any other song that has the same emotional effect. And that's maybe the reason. I also think like, if you're a writer, listening to Joni Mitchell will make you a better writer. Like just sentence for sentence, word for word, like it's the level of intelligence is so high, and the level of like emotional intelligence is so high. I don't know. I think that song is just like, I mean, that also could have been my answer for a song that makes you cry, because it is very, it's very affecting.
Yeah. It's such a good point about like how that first line like instantly puts you in a space that, like you said, most everybody has experienced.
Right. And the fact that the song just grows from there.
Yeah. Like,
that could have been enough for one song later to base a whole story, but she just keeps traveling and like bringing more people into it and starts quoting the guy she's going to. It's just like devastating, like in an almost journalistic sense. And at the same time, it's so beautiful, like melodically. Oh my God.
Right.
Like, the dulcimer, the way she like goes up on the word "you," like, I don't know, everything about it is really just virtuosic.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a perfect song. I don't know what, like, yeah, I got nothing.
She's the best.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I was thinking, pretty much every artist I love, like, So much music I love would not exist if she didn't make that song or that record, I guess, Blue. Like, to zoom out a little, I just think it it kind of set a new standard for how much it made it so that you couldn't, like, if you were going to write about this type of subject matter, you had to dig deep and you had to find something only you could present. And most people have not lived up to that standard. But, you know.
Yeah. But it's given people something to strive for 50 years. I don't even 60 year. I don't remember what year it came out, but, what's a song you used to love, but now if you think about it or you've heard it recently, it doesn't really do it for you in the same way.
Oh, so this is the one I picked, Vertigo by U2 for.
Oh man, that's a terrible song.
It does not hit.
No.
But I, for this one, I was like, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that, like, I liked as a kid that, like, it was a brief phase. But U2, I mean, I still really like U2 as a band, and they had a major impact on my life. The album before the one with Vertigo, All That You Can't Leave Behind, I was like, I was 8 years old when that came out, and it completely ruled my world. It was like, I literally would, like, carry the CD around with me. Like, I knew every song. And I think, like, by that point, I had already loved Bruce Springsteen, and he seemed like a human. Like, he seemed like a guy that was, like, he was from somewhere close to me, and you got to see him, like, age over the years, and, like, different. You two were like aliens to me. Like, they were from, like, another planet. And I was totally fascinated with it. And so the record after All That You Can't Leave Behind was the first record I really, like, followed online. I remember I was on the YouTube message board as, like, a kid. And I remember the anticipation and the rumors. I remember when, like, the suitcase full of demos got stolen, when, like,
oh yeah.
Like, I remember, and I would, like, talk about it in school. Like, when the album cover got revealed, I was like, guys, look. And it was, like, a black and white photo. They're 40. I was, like, so hyped. But, and so because of that, I was in a band at the time, and I brought Vertigo to the band to be like, we should play the song. I was like, if you want, I'll sing it, even though I was just, like, the guitar player. And so it became, like, a big part of my childhood was, like, singing that song and loving U2 and being really psyched about them. Obviously, like, the last 15 years, there's not been much to, like, be excited about as a U2 fan, maybe. So they've maybe, like, fallen off my, like, all-timers list at some point during my adulthood. But that reissue came out last year because it was the 20th anniversary of the album that Vertigo's on. And so I listened to it for the first time in a while. And yeah, the song is not, like, it's really a mess as, like, a piece of music. You know, I can hear them, like, going for what Beautiful Day did on the previous record. Like, it has a similar structure, like these kind of like muted verses, this big chorus, like this bridge that's sort of, like, copy pasted in, but it just doesn't work. Like, yeah. I mean, it worked, like, it did what they needed it to, but, like,
sure,
I can't imagine, like, that being in anyone's top 10, top 20 U2 songs.
Yeah, I'd be surprised. Yeah, I hadn't thought about this song. I think I don't remember the last time I thought about it, but and is it, like, some kind of inside joke or something? Why is it, like, 1, 2, 3, 14?
Yeah, I read, like, the Wikipedia page for it, and, like, Bono said it was because he was, like, drinking. But, like, it seems like, even that, though, it doesn't sound like the song's too polished for it to even, like, feel tossed off. Like, it doesn't do the thing they want it to do, which is sound like Bono's drunk, and this was, like, the only vocal take they did. It sounds like he rehearsed it. In fact, even the Uno, Dos, Tres, Catorce thing sounds like it's from different takes.
Right.
Each number. So I don't know. I couldn't tell you.
Maybe it's the 14th take. Maybe each one he, like, went up a number. I don't know.
I picked this, but I'm like, if I did go see U2 live, if I, like, flew out to Vegas and saw them at the Sphere and they played this song, I would probably be psyched to hear it live still. But yeah, it, the question was like a song you love that just doesn't do it for you. And I really did love that song as a kid.
I mean, you were covering it in with your band. I mean,
we played it at my bar mitzvah.
Oh man. Did so you sing it?
I did. My whole family heard me sing it. Yeah.
Amazing. the bird calls the formative years. Oh God. Okay. Well, what's a song that most people, some group of people, I don't know who they are. People hate it. You don't care. You love it.
So this one I like had to think about for a while because I'm just like out of touch with what people hate, or I just like don't care. But with this one, I went with Strangers in the Night by Frank Sinatra because I know he specifically hates that song. And it's not my favorite Sinatra song, but I like it. And Sinatra has been like a huge musical obsession of mine the last few years. And yeah, I know for a lot of people, it's like just his voice alone just makes them think of like the worst, worst aspects of like, I don't know, masculinity or pop culture or something like that. But I'm a big fan.
Yeah, when I hear Sinatra's voice, I just think about my grandma because she loved. Yeah, she was grew up. I mean, she was born in the 20s, so this was.
Oh yeah.
Every time we went over to her house when we were kids, it was either like Sinatra or Dean Martin or something like records playing. So yeah, like,
well, that's sweet. I feel like my entryway was like kind of like typical indie kid stuff where it's like I liked the weird stuff. Like I really liked that record Watertown. And then I had this podcast with Winston and Andy Cush called Late Era, and we talked about like later albums and artist's career, and we did an episode on Sinatra's Trilogy, which is a really weird record. And we had Greg Turkington on.
Oh wow.
Neil Hamburger. Yeah. And he's so deep into like singers and lounge singers and stuff, and it was such a fun conversation, and he made so many recommendations. And after that I like got a little deeper into Sinatra, and now I'm at a point where I like love all of it. I like every era of it I've listened to, and I like even got into like Sammy Davis Jr. records and Tony Bennett. Nice. It was Strangers in the Night. I think Sinatra was like so fickle with what he liked and what he liked to sing, and that was a song he like, I think he like said it was like the worst piece of shit he ever heard. Like, but he was like convinced to do it. And I don't know. I think he nailed it. Like he sang it really well. I mean, it's a really evocative song. Like so many of his songs, it just like really sets a mood.
Well, if it's not Strangers in the Night, what's the most romantic song?
This one, I went with like a personal favorite, which is My Baby Lives in Paris by Mia Doy Todd.
Nice.
She's amazing.
She's and so good.
That record, Cosmic Ocean Ship, is one of my all-time favorites. And that also was something I was thinking for like songs that cheer you up, because that's like one of the records I put on in my apartment when I don't know what I want to listen to. And, you know, because it just always kind of sweeps me away with it. And it makes me think of love and vacations and like beautiful scenery. But that song in particular, like I've always had really romantic, corny associations with France.
Sure.
I went to Paris once and it was everything that song promised. My girlfriend has like family in France and we're going in May.
Nice.
And yeah, I don't know. I love that song. I also, at every record I've made in the studio, I've thought about this song and this record because it's really subtly well orchestrated and arranged, but you never take the focus off her vocals.
Right.
It's really tasteful and beautiful. And any number of songs on this record could have been like my choice for most romantic, but something about this song, like, the French parts and like the part about like going to Edith Piaf's doorstep.
Right.
I just think it's beautiful.
Yeah. God, her voice is so, so captivating. Like I could listen to her sing anything, but yeah, this, I feel like this record, I feel like it's feels very underappreciated to me.
I think your old catalog is.
Well, yeah, I was gonna say.
But your earliest records are so good and they sound so current, like the ones that it's just her and guitar. Yeah, I feel like there's so much music that is like popular now that reminds me of it. But I think partially it's because she is, her music is so egoless. She's such a good collaborator, and it's so, the relationship people form with it is so personal, which I feel like is my relationship with it. But yeah, I do think Cosmic Ocean Ship is a really underrated album.
You could put this on at a party. I think it'd be okay.
Yeah, definitely. Maybe I should have done that. Yeah.
Okay, well, what's a song that changed your perspective on an artist, either for better or for worse?
This one I had a really specific answer for, which I went with the song The Frozen Man by James Taylor. Do you know that one?
I'm sure I'd heard it before, like when I was prepping for this. It like was vaguely familiar, but not enough that I have any, real relation to it.
I went pretty deep on James Taylor a few years ago. Like, full context is, growing up, my dad was like not a big music guy, but like one CD he had and loved was James Taylor's Greatest Hits. Which, like, for a kid, there's maybe not a lot to grab onto, especially if you're already like into like Springsteen. This just felt felt a little like kind of dopey or something. And then like even the art was just like so functional. It was just like, it was the album with like the white cover and just the song titles on it. So I think I always thought of James Taylor under the guise of like, I don't know, it was just like not for me. But then I like got a little more into his later stuff. And it was an interview I was doing for Pitchfork with John from the Mountain Goats, who, you know, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he can sell you on anything. Like, he's so like talking about music with him.
Oh yeah. One of my favorite people, like, yeah, John Darnielle is one of those people, you know, everyone's like, don't meet your heroes. It's like, unless it's like John Darnielle.
Totally.
Yeah. Never let me down. Anyway.
Yeah. So I interviewed him. And the very first question I asked, he responds by like looking into my eyes and quoting an entire verse from a James Taylor song. And the song is That's Why I'm Here, which is from like an album from the 80s when he was like, he was so sober and like newly content and like kind of getting his career back on track and feeling grateful for things. And so I listened to that record, and then I sort of like took myself all through the 90s. And The Frozen Man, I got really obsessed first because the guitar part is so cool. It kind of reminds me of like American Music Club, or like how Mark Eitzel plays guitar. It's like really it's like moody. And then the words, on one hand, it's like a really literal narrative about like a guy who's like cryogenically frozen, which is like kind of typical like James Taylor storytelling. But listening to it in the context of like understanding his life and his career, I was like, the song is such a profound metaphor for sobriety and like getting off heroin, which is what he was doing, and like looking at a life you wrecked and like coming to terms with your body again and coming to terms with how you feel about your past. It's a song that's really deeply felt. And there's even parts of it that remind me of, he's like thinking about being an artist at that stage in his career. Like when he's like, when I'm dead, make sure I'm gone. Don't leave him nothing to work on, which I think about now when anytime like there's a posthumous release from someone that they would have never wanted out. Yeah, I just think it's like a really deep song, and I didn't know he had it in him.
Right.
he's a deep writer.
It's funny. I'm glad this is your pick for this question, because I'm so intrigued by like I'd heard it before. I don't know, but yeah, it made me want to know more. It's kind of piqued an interest. Like, I'd never had an interest in James Taylor. And now, because I'm like, okay, wait, this is not what I expected. Like, I mean, it is on some level, but it's not at all.
Yeah.
So
It sort of like cracked open his writing for me, and it made it easier for me to identify the things in it that I really do connect with. Mm-hmm. And the things I think he did really well that maybe the critics who loathed him like throughout his career weren't would like toss off or like just like weren't aware of. But he has a really deep, rich, beautiful catalog of songs, and he's also a terrific guitar player. I love the guitar playing in this song. And it's very consistent with how he played throughout his career, which is a style that seems very unique to him. He earned my respect. And
I'm going to have to do the James Taylor deep dive.
Yeah, the record this song is on is one I would recommend. I mean, it has like it's some duds on it, but the high points are really high.
Okay.
It's called New Moonshine.
Okay. Weekend homework. All right, I feel like this next question, I can't decide if I think it was really hard for you or like really easy, but what are your favorite lyrics?
This was really hard for me. Because I feel like, I don't know about you, I'm like a really traditional like lyrics guy. Like most of my friends disagree with me, but always like, I feel like good lyrics can justify a bad song. Like if it's not melody, but it has good lyrics or something, I'm cool with it. But the reverse, I'm almost never cool with like a good song in every way. But if the lyrics suck, I'm not into it.
That's usually something I ask people, is like if lyrics can ruin a song for you, and because they can't, like bad lyrics can ruin an otherwise good song
all the time for me. Or like I just lose interest immediately. But for this I picked Lamb Chop because I think Kurt Wagner is like one of the great lyricists, and I find him to be really underrated. I hold him in very high esteem, and you almost never hear his name in these conversations. And I think it's partially because he's so shape-shifting musically, but he's remained so consistent and has even gotten better in some ways. But I think he's in a class of his own. I'm such a fan of his work.
I love Kurt Wagner. I think, I feel like Lamb Chop is, so underappreciated. And I think you're right, though, about the shape-shifting thing. I think it makes it harder for people to really... I don't know. Like that's appealing to me, the shape-shifting kind of this, it's like one of the things, for example, like Destroyer. I love about Destroyer is like, what the hell record is he going to do next?
Totally.
And I think he's another good example, but then it's like always it's like, oh, but it's clearly Dan Behar. Yeah. I think Lamb Chop's the same way. It's like, what's it going to be next? But it's still Kurt Wagner.
And I mean, Dan Behar is another writer I could have picked for this, but I feel like I picked Lamb Chop because whereas Dan Behar like kind of confounds me, like I can never dream of trying to write like Destroyer. Right. I feel like I've actually learned a lot about writing from how Kurt Wagner writes songs. And then when I like came pretty recently to a lot of poetry, which has been like the bulk of what I've been reading the last few years. And when I started reading it, I realized I like understood a lot of the flow of it because of how closely I've read like Lamb Chop lyrics. Like he reminds me
that's interesting.
Of the poets I adore. And the song I picked in particular, The New Cobweb Summer, is one of the ones I would point to. It's just a song like on the page alone, the words are so, they're so alive and electric, and pretty much every couplet, like every verse does something that I think is just so brilliant and inspiring. He's able to conjure such deep emotions in the most like surprising and unlikely ways. Like right off the bat, you have the line that's like, I mean, the opening line, I think is one of the best opening lines of a song. The last thought you think today has already happened. Amazing. The link between profound and pain covers you like Sherwin Williams. Amazing. and it just goes on. I think the verse about last night our boy was out there burning up his matches is like one of my favorite verses ever. It's because now you've got a kid in the mix, and it's it's like communal, like he's maybe singing to like his wife or something. But it's, and like the next, like you came home in the afternoon sporting a black eye. Like everyone knew that kid growing up, like was always like bruised and like, I don't know.
Yeah. Just,
it brings together all these familiar images. Yeah. And then that verse ends with the line that's like, as we grow into our bruises, which if that was the only line in the song, it would be profound.
Yeah.
But I don't know. He's so allergic to sentimentality and cliche. I just think it's, yeah, he's in a class of his own. I adore that song.
Yeah, no, I'm yeah, same. I love the song. I love Lamb Chop. I love, yeah, Lamb Chop as a woman is,
yeah,
such a great record. I think this is like only the second time in 70 episodes that Kurt Wagner has come up, which hurts my heart a little bit, but
I mean, I think about him all the time. Like really, when I started reading the poet Russell Edson, who's like been really influential to me, and like this sort of fable like writing, it really reminded me of how Kurt Wagner writes songs. Like he takes this very like folksy language and like familiar structures, but just infuses them with like dream logic and quotes and like product names. Like it's really inspiring and free and just completely divorced from like rock language. Like when I was writing this song of mine called My Life in Hollywood, I was like really, really like trying to write like him, like trying to put things in songs that I'd never heard in a lyric before without drawing attention to it, and trying to quote things, but like add little punchlines. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, can I think of another song that has Sherwin Williams in it?
Probably not. I mean, like maybe like a hip hop song.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like, which I think he's like a big rap fan, which makes sense.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. But his work is still really mysterious to me. Like, I mean, I picked the song, and part of it is that I don't really know what the song is about. Like, I don't even really know what the new Cobweb Summer means. Like, I have my own interpretation of it, but to me, that's like what I really aspire to as a writer, not to belie and like, not that people won't know what I'm talking about, but that like, I feel like the highest compliment you could pay like a song is like that I related to it in ways that like maybe you didn't intend, or like that you didn't write into it, you know, like
absolutely
you inhabited it or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I always think about that too, where like a song, you know, where you have that experience and then like you find out the actual meaning or whatever behind it, and it's just like, oh, and it's like totally like, which I think is, I actually think that's like really cool, because it goes to what you said, how it's like somebody wrote this song about this totally other thing, but wrote it in a way that I was able to connect to it and find my own meaning with it that makes perfect sense to me. Like you said, I think that's like the highest compliment that, you know. And yeah, I have no idea what most of his stuff, but I, you know, it's like it means something to me.
Yeah.
And yeah. So what song have you, or can you listen to the most?
So for this one, I looked at my streaming, like what song have I listened to the most? And I calculated, because there's different versions of it, that it's Coming Around Again by Carly Simon.
Hell yes.
Yeah. You're Dude. A fan.
Oh, massive fan.
Yeah.
Like
she is Carly, so good.
She is so good.
Yeah.
Like, oh, what a fucking songwriter.
And so good all the way through her career.
Yeah.
Like, each of her records has, like, at least one all-timer on it. And Coming Around Again is maybe my favorite Carly Simon song. And it's definitely the one I've listened to the most, if only for the end. Oh, my God. Like, the like climax at the end where she's like wailing. I've done this song at karaoke and like bummed out everyone in the room. But I do it because I know it by heart, because I've listened so many times. Yeah, I don't know. I find Carly Simon's music really wise and really comforting. And I love her voice. I love the weird chords she uses and the way she accompanies herself. I feel like her songs are built to listen to over and over again. They're so layered. Yeah. And then it's like you could listen to this song so many times and then realize it's the only song maybe ever that has the word souffle go right into the word scream. I don't know. She's just...
I feel like Kurt Wagner would appreciate that.
100%, yeah. I mean, I know Bill Callahan's a fan of Carly Simon, and it makes sense.
Yeah, that makes perfect
sense. Both of them are so observant. Like, you get the sense, like, when, like, she's listening to someone, she's just, like, peering into their soul. Like, I don't know. She writes in this very empathic way. That was my answer. Also, the production. I'm a sucker for like that big 80s sound. Yeah.
I always talk about like one of my most formative memories when I was a kid, and I'd stay home sick from church with my dad, and we'd listen to his like Dylan and Beach Boys records. But another super formative. My mom was a huge Carly Simon fan.
Me too. Yeah.
And so I. Like Carly Simon, like she was on a lot when I was a kid, and was again another big, she's amazing. And
yeah, it's good music for a kid too. Like I think hearing You're So Vain, which was one of my potential picks for objective best song ever, because I think it's up there. Like it was one of the first songs I heard as a kid that like kind of like knocked at the structure of being a song. Like, you know, it like, it incorporates the listener into it.
Yes.
And it's like an impossible question raised in the song. And that like fascinated me as a kid. But a lot of her songs do tricks like that. Like she's a really clever songwriter. And there's almost always some tension that's happening in like the subtext. This song too, like the structure of it being so cyclical. And the subject matter of it, like, returning. Beautiful song. Yeah, and the amazing. Other version of it I adore is the one that's on Greatest Hits Live. Really good.
I don't know that. I don't know. I can't remember that one. I'm gonna make my kid listen to it. she doesn't want to listen to anything I want to listen to, but
this could be a good bridge for her from Taylor Swift.
And I'm pretty sure that I've read that like Taylor Swift is a huge Carly Simon fan and cites her as an influence. So
yeah,
this is the gateway. Okay. What's the song you most recently fell in love with?
I have been on this huge kick lately with Bruce Cockburn. Are you familiar?
Yes.
Yeah.
And this song, dude, I love it. Yeah.
It's awesome. Probably
say what the song is.
The song is Wondering Where the Lions Are from his album, Dancing in the Dragon's Jaw, which I love that record.
And what is great titles. Great so album good. Title, great yeah. song.
Great guitar player, great writer. Yeah. Bruce Cockburn, for listeners who are unfamiliar, is a Canadian songwriter whose career has been so consistent and steady, and he's evolved so much. When he started, he was kind of like this downer folk guy. Then he found God and became basically this ecstatic Christian songwriter, which is the era this song comes from. And it's a really upbeat, beautiful, profound song. And then after that, he became more of like a protest singer and wrote a lot about the environment and eco-consciousness and protest songs. And that's kind of the wave he's been on for a while. And he's like mixed in a lot of different stuff in the last couple decades. But it's a really fun discography to explore. And basically all his records you can get really cheap used still. Like,
yeah.
And over the span of like a month, I went to record stores and like would pick them up for like $5, $8, which is kind of unheard of. Like used records are so expensive now. But I've been obsessed. And like when I go deep on an artist, like, it's all I think about. Like I've just been so like Cockburn brand lately. But this song, it's gorgeous. And it reminds me of Judy Sill actually. I think a lot of people like who love Judy Sill. I love Judy Sill. It's like there's no other music that like hits that same place of like cosmic wonder and like complexity and melodic simplicity, and the song kind of nails that for me, and it makes me think about like what she would have done if she had lived longer, and like gone to write protest songs in the 80s with a bunch of synths, you know. But yeah, Bruce Coburn, it's a really fun hole to go down if you haven't. His catalog is fantastic.
Yeah, this is I love this song. And the marimba is what it just like.
Oh yeah.
It just feels good. I don't know. And then it really does. Sort of accentuates that. I think I bought a bunch of his records for like $2-3 around here many years ago. And people don't know what they're missing.
Yeah, they're all so good. He was so good at so many things and remains good at so many things. I have this CD I was listening to called Slice of Life that's like live solo recordings from like the late 2000s. And that's amazing too. Like, I feel like that's probably the thing I'll listen to the most. Just him and a guitar. Beautiful.
I haven't heard that one, so I'm gonna have to I'll have to look that up. Probably can find it for like $2 somewhere. All right, well, what is the song that means the most to you, and not necessarily the song itself, but because of what you associate it with?
For this, I went with a song by my friend Dan Knishkui, who makes music as Adeline Hotel, this song called Whodunit, which is a beautiful, beautiful song. And Dan's been just like a really important person in my life. You know Dan, right?
Yeah, I interviewed him about this record last year.
I mean, the record is so good. But with Dan, we became really close during a time in our lives when we were like kind of at a similar point where a lot of stuff was changing and we were like working through some tough stuff. And I was writing the record of mine that's called Old Faithful, and he was writing this one. And I just feel like my proximity to what he was going through and watching him write these songs, it was a really important experience of my life. And just seeing how art can help people get through things and help them understand it better. And even the structure of the song Whodunit, I think, speaks to that. It's like it just kind of spills out. And I remember him sending it to me after he had first written it, and that was the way it felt, like, and just like this exfoliation almost. And it still feels that way when I listen to it and when I see him play it with the band, and hearing Jackie West sing it with him, the connection they have. It makes me emotional thinking about it. And I think I'll always probably have that association with that song.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful song. Completely unrelated to the song. So whenever I interview people, the last question I always ask them is, what are your favorite sounds in the world? And he has one of my absolute favorite answers, which was breaking a Yorkshire peppermint patty close to your ear.
Oh my God.
Which is like the most specific. And to be fair, like, cause my mom always had, like, at Christmas, she'll always have candy around the house, and she has like the little peppermint patty. So I did that over Christmas, and she was like, it's a really pleasing, weirdly, really pleasing sound.
That's also such a Dan answer. He's always like, I love the food imagery in his songs. He's really good at at conjuring like the senses with stuff like that. Yeah.
I'd love to hear him work that into a song. It'd be really evocative for like three people, and I would be one of them.
Yeah, me too.
All right. Last question, at least in this moment in time, what's your favorite song?
I went with Bonnie by Prefab Sprout.
Yeah, it's like, this is a song that it shocks me. This is like, what, 40 years old?
Yeah.
You can tell me this came out yesterday and I'd believe you.
I know. It's because it's so in its own world. It just doesn't sound like anything or feel like anything. And I feel like Patty McAloon from Prefab Sprout is the kind of songwriter who, once you like invest yourself in his work, you kind of can't write the same way or even like listen the same way. He's so, his eccentricities are so unique to him and so lovable. Like, I know he was obsessed with Michael Jackson, and you can kind of tell, like, his songs are so kinetic and fun and, immediate while still being so weird. And Bonnie, I think, is just like, it's kind of like his masterpiece. It has the tension of it. I think about it all the time, just like the chord progression, the way it's structured, like the long pauses between lines. I don't know. It's amazing. When I listen to Prefab Sprout for the first time, I feel like I never wrote a song the same way after. I feel like it gave me permission to try to like be funnier and be more myself, and like incorporate everything I loved into it. And I don't know. Yeah. Even though he has kind of like a diss track about Springsteen, that song Cars and Girls, even that is an amazing song. Like, he's right.
That's like the highest praise you can get.
Yeah. I also think like, when you meet someone else who like loves Prefab Sprout a lot, it's like, you feel like you connect on like an elemental level, maybe.
Yeah. No, that's a good way to put it. Yeah. There's so many moving parts on this song, but it never like quite feels like it.
Yeah.
I don't know. It doesn't, like I said, it doesn't sound like anything else. It's a good, it's probably one of my favorite songs too.
I also think it's like one of those, like, yeah, when you share this song with people, it's like the best feeling ever. Like when they love it and it like changes their life.
This is one of those songs. Yeah. Like I have like a whole, like, I'm doing like a remix version of this podcast. I don't know if you've heard the Jeff Tobias episode, but so I got people on again, so it's all new questions. And I think this is one of the questions. I don't know if I ended up keeping it, was like, what's your favorite song to introduce people to first time? And like, this is one of the ones that came to mind when I was like writing that question, because like you said, just seeing people hear it for the first time and it land. And just, yeah, it's like it does. It unlocks some other part of your brain or something.
Yeah, definitely. And while still being like a really emotional, like immediate experience, like it feels like a pop song, even though it's so weird. And the lyrics are so abstract at times. I'm like, I don't know if I've ever read like an interpretation of what he's actually singing about, but like, I don't know.
I don't know that I have either. I don't think it matters.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, awesome. Well, hell, that's a hell of a place to end it. So thanks for doing this. This is a lot of fun.
So fun. Thanks, Brad.
Absolutely. And Melody Trail by the Bird Calls. God, why can't I say that? Melody Trail by the Bird Calls. It's out on February 7th. You got any like shows or anything coming up that you want to mention?
Yeah, a bunch of shows. I'm not sure what'll be announced by the time this comes out, but the release show is happening February 10th at the Tradesman in Brooklyn. I'm playing the Mercury Lounge in May with Advance Bass and Kristen Dalen, who are both songwriters I love a lot. And that's maybe it for now. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, everybody watch, I don't know, buy the record, go see him. Is it going to be your full band for the release show?
Yeah, that's going to be awesome. The first full band show we're doing.
Amazing.
I can't wait.
Oh, that's exciting. Awesome. Well, thanks again.
Sweet. Thanks, Brad. That'll hit.
Once again, thank you to Sam Sadomski for taking some time out, talking to me on a Friday afternoon. Bird Calls, not the Birdhouse, Bird Calls. Melody Trail is out now on Ruination. Huge recommendation on that. It's an album that I think of a lot of albums, is like a lot of music can kind of get seasonal for me. This one, we had a few days. So I've had a copy of this for a little while, but like we've had a few days in the last few weeks where it's been spring-like. It's been in the 70s, and man, putting this, sitting there on the porch, doing some work on some things, putting this album on, sun shining down, cool breeze, warm sun, all of that, oh, really just took it to another level. So check that out. Listen to Sam's picks, the playlist link in the show notes. And yeah, it's all good stuff. As ever,
If you like the show, please leave a rating or review wherever you are listening to podcasts. That really helps with all this algorithmic bullshit. And if you really like the show, really like what Foxy Digitalis does, and just want to support that, patreon.com/FoxyDigitalis. For as little as $3 a month, you can get these episodes early. You get a whole extra section. If you do $5 a month, you get a bunch of other stuff on top of that, like some of my music and just, different things. But yeah, as always, though, I appreciate y'all listening. And until next time, keep on listening, whatever the hell you want. I mean, do whatever the hell you want, too. That's fine.